and achieves the same aim.
Yes, that's right. But if you want to work with the whole Hilbert space that you get from the beginning, so where all the spin networks are in, then of course you get these modernized.
But that really depends on what you want. I mean, if your algebra contains all possible paths, then this doesn't work.
Sure.
So if you have polynomial operators, that doesn't work.
All right. Okay. As I just said, Valigno introduced these choices range from, I mean, these are sort of not causally, but rather from very mild to very, very wild extensions of this group. And I'm talking about, today I want to talk about, in particular, about this group, the last group that is down here, for two reasons. As I said, there are several suggestions for these, and which of these you choose has an effect on how the invariant Hilbert space of your final theory looks like. In particular, makes it easier or less easy to find things like an orthomorphic basis in it, for instance. So the thing down here, as we'll later see, will lead to something that is purely combinatorial, which makes things really, really nice and easy to calculate, at least from this conceptual point of view. There's another reason why this is somehow worth investigating, I think, and you pointed this out, that the notions of loop quantum gravity basically can be formulated in category theory, just in the language of category theory. In this language, the extension going from smooth to distributional for the connections, for the gauge transformations, is something really natural. So if in category theory, this looks really, really nice and immediate what happens there. And if you do the same thing for the diffeomorphisms, you end up with this group down there. So at least from this mathematical point of view, it looks quite beautiful what's happening, and that was another reason why we considered this. So the problem is, in order to show you this, I have to briefly introduce notions from category theory. Category theory is just language in some sense. So you use category theory if you're not interested in what you're really doing, but in just what the structure of the things look like. So I will be really brief about this. If you know about category theory already, then this will be boring. If you don't know, then just be assured that, yes, there is this language to formulate these things, which is really nice, and just combinatorial. Okay. So what is a category? A category consists of two things, a bunch of objects, x, y, or so. And between any two objects, there are a set of morphisms. You think of them like arrows. One arrow from x to y, this is f, and they are in such a way that they can be composed. So if there's an arrow from x to y and from y to z, then you can compose them and build an f circle. If you have f and g, then you can just make the composition, which is like both of them. And this composition is associative, and there's an identity arrow on each object.
And f and g is contained in a category.
Yes. So this is then another morphism from x to z. Yes, I know. In category, I hope that no one would point this out. In category literature, this is always g circle f. I mean, in most of mathematical literature, this is g circle f, but I want to be in f circle g for some reason. Okay, so you can think of this for an example. I mean, the most prominent example, one of the prominent examples is the objects are all smooth manifolds, and the arrows between two manifolds are all just all the smooth maps. So I can concatenate smooth maps to get another smooth map. This can get associated with the identity map of smooth. And so this is just a language term in which many, many, many structures of physics can be formulated. There are two more notions that we need. The first is a functor. A functor between two categories is, so to speak, a structure-preserving map between these. So objects are mapped to objects. So objects here are mapped to objects in here. And morphisms from x to y in here are mapped to other morphisms going from f of x to f of y, such that this nice composition will hold. So again, think of C and D being smooth manifolds that I've just introduced. If x is a smooth manifold, then this is the tangent bundle of x, for instance. And if f is a map from x to y, then the Cartan differential from f goes to tangent bundle of x to tangent bundle of y. And this is then just nothing but the chain rule. So the Cartan differential is a functor. The last thing to say is, between functors, so this is the last step now, there are natural transformations which just want to tell you a way of comparing functors with each other. So two functors, you can say that two functors are not too different in some way. If there are a set of morphisms in the D category, such the action of the two functors F and G here, which can be related by natural transformation, are somehow intertwined by these morphisms. So if you have seen this before, then you know what it means. If you haven't seen this before, then don't bother to remember this now. It's just you should know that there is this notion of natural transformation, which tells you that functors are somehow not too different from each other. Okay, so now these are just language. Now I will kind of tell you how all this shows up in loop quantum gravity. In loop quantum gravity, the groundwork is some specific category, which is the so-called path group by category, the objects of which are points in three-dimensional space, sigma, and the morphisms between two points are paths from x to y. So if x and y are paths in sigma, then, a morphism is just a path, piecewise analytic path, which means that it's a curve modulo reparametrization and modulo retracing. And if I have another path going from y to z, of course, I just compose these two paths by concatenating them.
But now I'm confused. I mean, in the category, the morphism is really just the map from x to y. Like, here you have different path levels, you have many different curves going between x and y. So
yes, that's right. Between two objects, there can be many, many different morphisms. Mm-hmm. That's right. There can also be no morphisms, if you like. For instance, if the category is... If the manifold is not connected. So then there might, between two points, there might be no path. Okay, so if there's another path going from y to z, then you just put these two paths behind each other. And this is meant to be in some way that these retracings, that is going down here, going up, going down, is going to cancel each other out. So that if this is p and this is q, then the concatenation of them is just going down. Okay, so this is the path group point that we're working with, and now we observe that a smooth connection assigns, of course, to each path the Hilonomy along that path, right? This is the path of exponential. Given a connection, what does a connection do? It takes a path and maps it to an element of the gauge, maps a path to its parallel transport, in particular in the following way, that if I have two paths, first the one and then the other, then I can compute the... I can compute the holonomy separately and then just multiply the group elements.
I'm confused. You're not limiting yourself to closed paths?
No, not only closed paths, but any path.
So it's not just an element of the group, actually. I mean, there's a kind of gauge ambiguity.
You're right. I mean, as soon as these are three-dimensional manifolds, then the tangent bundle is trivial. So you find a global trivialization for this, and this it's just an element of the group, of the gauge group. Is that what you mean? Otherwise, it would be a map from one tangent space to the other. But let's just for simplicity think of this being just a trivial bundle, which for three-dimensional manifolds is always true, for instance. Okay, in the category language, this doesn't mean anything different, but let's say that A is a functor. A is a functor from this path groupoid to the gauge group. I mean, making the gauge group into a category in some fancy way, which I'm not going to describe you. But I mean, only this equation should convince you that this is just nothing but a functor. So some structure-preserving map from the path groupoid to the gauge group. I mean, you can also, I've probably also seen this, that is the path groupoid homomorphisms from P to G, and this is exactly what's going on. Okay, you know that if two connections. I mean, how do holonomy change under gauge transformation? I mean, if I have one holonomy along one P, what changes if I do a gauge transformation? I mean, it changes exactly via this formula. So two connections can be related by a gauge transformation if there's such a smooth map from sigma to G, particular gauge transformation, such that this formula holds. But if you now multiply from G of Y from the right, and this disappears and shows up here, then this is exactly the formula that you had for the natural transformations. So, you start later, right? So in category language, these can be related by a gauge transformation, means the functors can be related by a natural transformation. So in the category language, this gauge transformations are just natural transformations. Okay, let's go on. Diffeomorphisms maps, of course, points to points and paths to paths. In the following way, maps sigma to sigma. So there's a point x, a point y, there's a path from x to y, and the diffeomorphism just does nothing like mapping points to other points and mapping this path to other paths.
When you say natural transformation, mm-hmm. in general you would want to say it's invertible if you want to say that it's a gauge transformation. I don't know whether
yes, that's right. I think in this framework, all natural transformations are invertible. I mean, not for every category, of course.
Your morphism is on the group of...
Yes, because you have the magnitude of the gauge group, which is a group. So you can just invert all this.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I mean, there are maps in a group into itself, into the identity. I don't know how it would work out, but... It may be your notion of group morphism to automorphism. I mean, to invertible. Yeah, on the group, or doesn't matter?
No. I agree. For general categories, natural transformations, there's no meaning of them to invert them. So. But in this particular case, they all are. And that's just because the A's are functors from the path groupoid to the gauge group. And these are groups, and if you write down the definitions, you can just reverse all these things. So this is the natural transformations are all invertible. Okay. What does a diffeomorphism do here? In category language, I mean, it maps points to points and paths to paths in the following way. If P is a path from X to Y, then phi of P is a path from phi of X to phi of Y. So this is nothing but an invertible functor from the category P to itself. So, and this is basically what's called an automorphism. Okay, so what happened? I told you that every smooth connection is a functor. From the path group to the gauge group. And it can be shown that the distributional extension is just the set of all functors from P to Q. Every smooth gauge transformation induces a natural transformation on these functors, and it's quite easy to see that the distributional extension that is used is simply the set of all natural transformations on these functors. So in the category language, this extension means just look at the category content of what you're doing and forget any condition about smoothness. So this is just what's happening here. And as I said, every diffeomorphism induces an automorphism on the path groupoid. And this, well, if you just copy what's happened here, then the suggestion is that one could try to take just all automorphisms as a distributional extension of the diffeomorphism.
So, I mean, what seems weird about that is if you wanted to do the category of combinatorial graphs and connections on combinatorial graphs, mm-hmm. you would just start off saying, I have a category of points and arrows, mm-hmm. and I have a functor from that to a group. Mm-hmm. And I could just do that. When you take the last, you took the trouble of embedding your points and paths in a manifold of a certain dimension, mm-hmm. and then your last step, you just remove that structure. As you go back to what would have been the category of just maps from points and maps to the gauge group.
Exactly. Yeah.
So why go through all this stuff? Why don't you say I'm interested in the gauge theory on combinatorial graphs? I mean, well, if you're not doing anything but going through a complicated route, you just say something very simple.
No, I mean, if you start from the outset that we have here, then this is a non-trivial step because you have the manifold in the beginning, right?
You lose an enormous amount of structure that is there because of the manifold. So you might as well just not have, in fact, you lose all the structure that's there because there's a manifold of a certain dimension, a certain topology, and so forth.
Exactly.
So you might as well not have put it in to begin with.
Well, of course one could have put this in just and started, but then it would probably not be really, well, it could come from nowhere in some sense, right? Well, and here you can see that even if you start.
If you get to that step, I mean, it doesn't matter if the path you take. If you want to, I mean, it's great if you want to do the theory of gate theories on combinatorial graphs. That's a great thing to do. It's well studied. Mm. You know, you can do it, and there's very interesting recent work with, you know, Thomas and Christine and so forth with the version of Dupont gravity mm-hmm. on combinatorial graphs. That's great. But don't tell a whole complicated story in which you put in the manifold and then you take it away, just to tell a very simple story.
But he doesn't take it away.
What?
He doesn't take it away. This is the derivation.
I don't think that's a derivation. It's just a fiat. The last step is just a fiat.
Well, so is the manifold gone in the end?
What remains of it? It's just nothing.
Well, I will show you what remains
something
in the end.
Yes. It still has these pairs are.
Can you talk about the dimension?
Is the dimension still encoded in
what you have to get? Not, at least one can't see it like that, but I just don't want to talk about this now, right? To save the punchline for the end. But, yes, of course you're right. You could have started with just combinatorial graphs from the beginning, right? But what this shows is that if you start even with a manifold, and are just interested in what the combinatorics are of these things that happen, in particular of what all the automorphisms leave invariant, then you can calculate all this through, and at the end you get at something different, which is just different than just combinatorial graphs, which I will show you. So this is not just arriving at combinatorial graphs at the end. So, but this is something different. I mean, it's just a derived concept from that. Okay, so as I said, we try to look at the effect of what happens if we take the automorphism, the path group automorphisms, as distribution extensions of the diffeomorphisms. And first, I'll talk about some properties of these. I mean, of course, they all act on the connections, right? So, and then they act on the connection in a very, very nice way. So, first of all, I mean, this is the space of connections, and it has a topology and it has a measure on which all of the Lucrenian gravity is based. And this is, in particular, a homomorphism, but it's continuous, which is very nice, which is also quite easy to see. What is furthermore true is that the automorphisms also preserve the Ashtikar-Lewandowski measure. Strangely enough, this is not at all trivial to see, but this rests in some really deep connection between combinatorial group theory and on the measure theory on the compact Lie groups, which is the gauge. So this rests basically on some classical result from Nielsen from the 30s, saying about how automorphisms of free group act and how they can compose of simple ones, and these simple ones are exactly the ones that leave the leave the Haar measure on products of groups in the variant. So this is something. This is something really, really difficult to show for some strange reason. At least it's never that it's true. Okay, so what this, of course, tells you that is that the automorphisms all act unitarily on this Hilbert space, which is, of course, the starting work of why you can see all the automorphisms as a symmetry. If they weren't acting unitarily, then you couldn't really employ them as a symmetry group, because, yeah, I mean, symmetries are unitary. Okay, so what do automorphisms do? We've already heard about this. So points are mapped to points and paths are mapped to paths in some way that one path is going from x to y, then of course the mapped path has the maps from phi of x to phi of y, and of course that decomposition holds. So this is just the definition of a function down. But of course a path itself consists of many points. But the important thing about automorphisms is that what happens to the path and what happens to the points that constitute the path is not the same. So this is really strange, but you can see that if z lies on the path p, then phi of z does not have to lie on phi of p. And this is, I mean, but this is really strange. I mean, you could say, oh, come on, z lies on p, so I can just decompose this from x to z and from z to y, use this formula, so the final path is to go from phi of x to phi of z and from phi of z to phi of y, so phi of z has to be on the path. But that's not true, simply because retracings cancel out. You can see this is the following thing. You have a path, z lies on that path, you can decompose p into p1 and p2, going from x to z and from z to y, and the image of p1 goes down here, goes up, phi of z, and the image of p2 starts at phi of z, goes down, goes over here, and the image of p is the whole thing, is there, going up, going down, going there. But since the retracing is cancelled, this is just the image of phi of p. So in fact, phi of z does not have to lie on phi of p. And this is in some sense, really a really mighty concept in the way that it makes this group tremendously large. There are many, many more elements than just maps from sigma to sigma.
So the query about what's the largest extension of the diffeomorphism group such that points go along with their curves?
That's the graphomorphisms from Flagstaff. So if you look at the category where you don't cancel out the retracings, but only look at Crookes' modular reparameterization and look on the invertible functors on them, then you get the graphomorphisms. But here the retracings cancel out, and if you take this into account, then you see that this group becomes tremendously large. In particular, given any bijection of points, like without any continuity or without anything, you can write down an automorphism, well, at least if you have the accent of choice, but you can write down an automorphism who does, on the objects, does this job, but leave the combinatorics of paths essentially invariant. The other extreme of this is it's an automorphism whose action on the objects, that is on the point, is the identity, it's trivial, but it swaps two edges starting and ending at the same point. And leaving all invariant all other paths that have nothing to do with these two edges. So in this sense, this is really a distributional diffeomorphism, so in the sense that the support of it is really only lying on these two edges.
Will you give an example of that?
Yes, exactly, I will. So consider two paths. And to tell you what this automorphism does, I have to tell you what happens with finite segments of that path. So I'm going to tell you what happens to a finite segment of these two edges. This is P, then P going from there to there is mapped to starting at the same vertex, going down, going over there, and going up again. So you choose, so to speak, for every point here, a companion point down there, and choose a connection path. So and then for an arbitrary path, you have to decompose this into parts that have nothing to do with the edges and go along the edges. And then the image of this one under this would then be like looking like that. So, which looks complicated, but again, in particular after that, the path intersects with itself. And in particular, with the help of these edge interchanges, one can show that given two graphs that have the same combinatorics, then there is an automorphism that maps the two graphs into each other. So I'm writing this down shorthanded, notation down here. So in fact, this is more general. You can also do this for hives. If you don't know what a hive is, then it's okay. A hive is, a graph is a set of vertices and edges between them. A hive is a set of vertices and paths between them that are allowed to intersect and partially overlap. And so this is a bit more general, but the same theorem holds also for hives. So this makes, as you can probably imagine, the Hilbert space invariant of these things quite small. The symmetry groups are large. So what do automorphisms do then? They only respect the fact that the parallel transport along paths are independent and the connections, the combinatorics of these paths. So look at this example. You have three paths, all starting at the same vertex, ending at different vertices, and the parallel transport among these paths is independent. The same is true for these things. I don't know whether you can see. So the first path starts at phi of x, goes to phi of y1. The second path, which is the image of this one under the automorphism, starts at the same one, goes here, and the image of that path starts here and goes over there. In particular, there is an automorphism mapping this configuration to this configuration. So the only thing that these automorphisms realize is that there are three paths starting at the same vertex, ending at different ones, and that the parallel transport among them is independent of each other. So they don't really care about how these paths are embedded into space. Okay, so next thing is now, what is the action of these automorphisms on a function which is cylindrical over a graph gamma, for instance? So this is not, this is a bit difficult to see, in particular because if gamma is a graph, then phi of gamma is not necessarily a graph. I mean, assume you have this small graph here, if two vertices and two edges starting at one and ending at the other, then it can be mapped to these two vertices. The image of the first path is this one, the image of the second path is this one, but they go along the same lines for a short while. It's just that the parallel transport among these two is just independent, so these two can be mapped to each other.
So it is typical, they do preserve the closedness of paths.
Yes. Yes, yes. They preserve the closed. I mean, the combinatorics has to be the same. Right? It's two vertices started the same, start ended the same. At least on the path groupoid level. I mean, on the function level, we will see what happens. So, consider this graph: four vertices. Five vertices, four edges, and all having this little cross.
Could you explain cylindrically?
Oh, yes, okay, I will. So this is an element of the Hilbert space, if you like, which is a linear combination of spin networks over this graph. So this function depends on holonomies, but it depends on holonomies in a very simple way. It depends on holonomies only about along these lines. So it only depends on what the connection does along these lines. So if the function is cylindrical over this graph, it means that there's this big function f down here, which maps four copies of the gate group to C, such that f of A just depends on what A does along these four lines here, four edges. Okay, so I mean, in particular for one graph, all the cylindrical functions can be modeled from spin network functions of this. Okay, so now let's say this cylindrical function, which depends on these four holonomies, but in a special way, namely in the following, that it only depends on the product of the holonomy from there and there, and the product of the holonomies from E3 and E4. So this function f here has four arguments, but it basically depends on these four arguments only in these combinatorics of these two products down here. So it only really depends on the product of the holonomy along the first, the holonomy along the second, and the holonomy along the third, and the holonomy along the fourth element.
How do you keep? How do you choose these ordering? Why H2, H3, H4?
This is just an example to tell you what these automorphisms are able to do. I mean, was that your question? I mean,
yeah, well,
you can choose these functions.
You can choose another ordering.
I could choose any other function. Okay. Right? It's just an example of telling you of what's going to happen next. I mean, these are four paths. E1 and E3 end at the same vertex at which E2 and E4 are starting. And so there's an automorphism mapping this to this configuration, right? So the vertices stay the same, but phi of E1 goes over there, goes down. Phi of E2 goes over there, goes there. Phi of E3 goes over there, goes up. Phi of E4 goes down, goes over there. And the cylindrical function, which is an element of the kinematical Hilbert space, can be shifted around by this automorphism to be a cylindrical function over this A. So, but since our original function only depended on the combination there down E1, E2, and E3, E4, this one will only depend on phi of E1 times phi of E2,
yes,
and phi of E3 times phi of E4. But, I mean, this function, but then these retracings are cancelled. And in fact, this function is only cylindrical over this and over that edge. So this function is cylindrical over a graph that looks different than the one that we were starting with. But in some sense, this is pretty natural because, I mean, this function did not know about the graph having this vertex, right? This function really only depended on two edges in some way. It's on two paths, this path and that path. But the function itself had no idea that these paths are meeting somewhere. In particular, this function is, in this construction, you automatically gauge invariant with respect to gauging at this vertex. So this is the big moral that one can take out of this. These functions don't know everything about the graph, or some of them don't know everything about the graph. And I only know about the combinatorics paths that they are cylindrical over, and the automorphisms preserve exactly only that. So as I said, again, so this is only because of this particular choice of F. Another F will, by the same automorphism, not be mapped to this, depending only on these two. Okay, but this is really severe in some way. This is a really mighty thing, just because look at gauge invariant spin networks. I mean, gauge invariant spin networks don't depend on holonomies, let alone any just edge. Take a gauge invariant spin network, a gauge invariant function on the graph. They just don't depend on single holonomies, but they only depend on holonomies around closed loops. In particular, the gauge invariant functions, which is the gauge invariant spin network functions, only depend on how many loops, as many loops, holonomies around as many loops, as there are holes in the graph, so to speak. So they measure the first fundamental group. And in fact, there is an automorphism mapping this function on this graph to a function on this flower graph. Of course, on the path groupoid level, this doesn't happen. The path groupoid, the combinatorics has to be the same. So this graph is mapped to some other big graph, of which this flower graph is only a subgraph. But the function only depends on the subgraph, so I didn't draw all the rest. So in this sense, the automorphisms filter out the real dependence of the functions on which paths they are cylindrical over and which they aren't. So this is for general gauge group. For abelian gauge group, for gauge group U1, there's even some even more dramatic consequence of what I just told you. And if you choose the gauge group being abelian, like being U1, then one can show that for every charge network, so this is the analog of the spin network just for U1, and this is the distribution of numbers along these edges. If this is gauge invariant, it's the numbers of all incoming minus the numbers of all outgoing is zero at each vertex, then there is an automorphism mapping this to a single Wilson loop, just only one circle. But this, with one charge, and this charge is the greatest common divisor of all of these, so it's just a combinatorial thing. The reason for this is that these functions really only are cylindrical over one path. This path is wrapped around in some proper way along this, to build up this graph, but the combinatorics of this, I mean, what the function really knows is really that it's cylindrical over one closed loop. Okay, so...
Are these n supposed to be real numbers?
No, I'm sorry, these are the chart, these are integer numbers.
The integer.
Yes, these are the charges of your point. So that's how the spin networks, I mean, they have the J labels, and so this is the same. Okay, so for G equals U1, you can immediately compute the automorphism invariant Hilbert space. I mean, the general automorphism invariant vector just is a linear combination of Wilson loops with different n, and of the equivalence class under automorphisms, these Wilson loops of n. I mean, every charge network function can be mapped to one of these, so in the orbit of every charge network functions, one of these and only one of these pops up. So you can build up a general automorphism function out of these. Okay, so this is so simple that you can actually compute it. For SU2, this is fortunately, more complicated, in particular because if we look at, for instance, this flower graph, this cannot just be written as a cylindrical function over one loop or so that's wrapped around. But for instance, but by a linear combination of two loops, like one of them is the loop, one loop starting here, going there, exactly. Self-intersecting, but the function doesn't know about it. And the other one is consisting of the two loops here. So I've written this symbolically as this. So every gauge invariant function on this graph, spin labels 1/2 and 1/2, and any intertwining here can be decomposed into these loops. I mean, the intertwining space is two-dimensional. This is basis. So a function can be basically decomposed into traces along these, one of them of the products, and one of the roof of two apartments, two apartments. And well, unfortunately for higher graphs, the combinatorics of this becomes really, really complicated, and it's not really easy to do, it's not easy to see, but there's a very good hint that we conjecture this to be true, that this basically is true for all higher graphs also, and these are in fact enough to do. So this would mean that a general automorphism invariant vector here could be built up as a linear combination of equivalence classes of gauge invariant functions over many, many separate loops, each of them having a different spin.
This is for SU2.
This is for SU2.
Yeah. I mean, Renat alone had something like this. It's because this got to be so complicated that we started going back and using spin networks as the basis.
It's unfortunate. This really looks like these Mandelstam things, right?
There was some bad period in which we didn't appreciate the importance of it. We always knew about the spin network basis, but we didn't appreciate the importance of it, and we were doing crazy things like this, which were technically very...
Yeah, unfortunately, this is not exactly the same, because if you have a general gauge invariant function on the graph, then you can decompose it in many loops in this way that you just indicated how people did this, but some of them will be dependent. But the automorphism is not able to separate loops that are dependent. So the combinatorics of these loops still stay the same. So here it looks, and here in fact it is the same thing that you just did for higher, which you just said, for higher graphs, it's unfortunately a bit more complicated. So it's not exactly easy to see how you can do this.
So my point is that therefore the spin network basis is a convenient basis compared to
I agree, of course. But I mean, this is not decomposing this into the loop basis. This is something different.
Could you choose these graphs, these loops, to be anywhere?
Yes, basically. I mean, they are not allowed to be exactly on over the same. They are not allowed to exactly lie over top of each other.
Okay, there's all pairs of loops are equivalent.
Yes. If there's a loop there or there, I mean, not more than come back. That's
just
Isaac.
I see, yeah. That's just the diffeomorphism.
Yes, you can even do this by diffeomorphism already. Although a diffeomorphism, for instance, can't do kinks or so. So this could be mapped to square.
You're only interested in functions which are diffeomorphic. Functions psi, which are diffeomorphic.
Sorry, Eric?
Are you interested only in functions psi, which are invariant under your automorphism?
Yes. The automorphisms are mapping the surface also to everywhere. And also...
But I said the function psi that you're... I think you called it psi.
Yes. This is the one
that's... It's to the automorphism.
Invariant.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So, this, of course, is some equation that is meant to be symbolically, but if you make... the brackets around denoting equivalence classes under automorphisms, and this is in fact really true. Okay, unfortunate thing is that this basis is not really an orthonormal basis that we get, because I mean even these two functions they are not orthogonal to each other, but they have some non-trivial overlap. But I mean, as soon as you know that this is a basis, then you can use the Gram-Schmidt procedure to get an orthonormal basis.
Yeah, that's my point. And after a lot of work, you end up back with spin networks, so you think of the orthonormal basis.
So,
in some sense, you're reversing what. After you do all the work to get to extract out an orthonormal basis, you'll be back with the basis labeled by spin networks.
You mean in here?
Yes.
No.
If I understand what you're doing, maybe I misunderstand what you're doing. But. Let me ask you this. Suppose you did this on a lattice. I gave you just a regular lattice. There's no reason you shouldn't be able to do this on a lattice.
Well, on a lattice? Well, of course you can write out the path group, but
yes.
Just on the lattice. This kind of finite lattice. There, if you look at the automorphisms of this path group point,
mm-hmm.
the automorphisms of this path group are different because this is just really this finite lattice. You cannot shift these things arbitrarily around. It's just have to stick on that lattice. So if you really only talk about
I think D means what happens if you just use a graph just happens to be a regular lattice. Is that the question?
No.
If there's really just only the lattice, then it will be different because you will get something like the automorphism group will be much slower, much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And there you will get something like a combinatorial graph.
Okay.
I think. Although I haven't looked at it, but I think this would be the case. Here, since you have a three-dimensional manifold, you have so much space to move things around, you're not stuck with one fixed graph.
So do you have a nice characterization of what happens when you branch with everything?
I've
the general case?
No, I've tried to do this for small flower graphs, for instance. I mean, you only have to consider flower graphs because you can have every gauge invariant function of lattice one on a flower graph. So you only have to look at the orbits and what happens on flower graphs, of course. But I mean, for lower dimensional flower graphs, I've looked at what these things would look like. And yeah, so far, I mean, they're really formal bases. They're really formal bases. But it's difficult to see what the numerical prefactors would be if you use this Gramscian procedure to make them into an orthogonal basis. But I mean, yeah, this is really the basis that you're getting out here. Yeah. Okay, so my time is up. So let me just summarize what we did. If we looked at what happens if you extend the diffeomorphism group, diff sigma, to one real larger group of the group of path group of automorphisms. So this is some choice and some extension that is somewhat inspired by category theory, if you like. But we're really interested in what happens if you take the biggest symmetry group that you can take at all. So in some sense, the automorphisms are the biggest extension that you can take of the diffeomorphisms. The other reason why we did this was that, of course, it looks natural from just the mathematical framework, which of course is just nice fact. And of course, that we wanted to make something like see whether the combinatorial picture comes out, which in this sense does. The automorphisms are really nice because they behave nice with the topology and the measure, which I told you is much, it's really not ready to show, which is true. And this group is really large. So the two graphs with the same combinatorics can be mapped to each other, simply because the automorphisms only look at what happens with path combinatorics and how these paths are relative to space. This also shows you something about the path group. It shows you how little information the path group contains about the spatial manifold sigma itself. Path group, for instance, doesn't know anything about topology. I mean, if I say combinatorically different, I not only mean not in classes, but I really mean like sigma being a torus, one graph going around the whole, the other graph being contractible. Still, there's an automorphism mapping these two to each other.
So, Mikhail asked before, does it know about the dimension?
This is in fact a very good question, and I have discussed with Christian Flaschak a lot about this. He also, in his dissertation, worked a lot with these path group points, and in particular with this mathematical framework of Heif's, and I'd say no, but this is only my belief so far.
So if it doesn't know the topology, if it doesn't know the dimension, then it doesn't know anything. Yeah, so it's just is combinatorial graph doing when you're done.
I think so. Doesn't know about the dimension of the manifold in which you embed your graphs, at least. But as I said, this is just a conjecture. I'm not sure. It might be that there is no endomorphism between the path group of a two-dimensional and a path group of a three-dimensional. Well, no, of a two-dimensional, it's probably easy to show that a two-dimensional manifold, that the path group of a two-dimensional manifold is not endomorphic to a path group of a, say, four-dimensional manifold. But three and four might be the same.
Yeah, maybe the three and up there are the same.
Yes, that's because, I mean, if you're looking at paths, and paths can move from one point to the other without intersecting any other any other path finitely many
it's
paths.
It's probably true that two is a special case.
I think so, yes. I think so. Okay. Mr. Layton. We've computed the automorphism in Baron Hilbert space.
Do you know the number of connected components?
Yes.
So there's something.
Yes, you're right. Well, I was always thinking about, well, I mean, a physicist, for me, a manifold with two components is, are two manifolds. So, but of course, you're right. No, it knows these things. So we have looked at the orbits of the automorphisms on this kinematic Hilbert space, and in particular, computed the automorphism invariant Hilbert space for g equals u1 and made a guess about how this looks on g equals su2. And we can see that only the combinatorial information of this of cylindrical functions is preserved by this. In particular, the general element of the automorphism invariant Hilbert space for g equals u1 would look like this. And as I said, we conjecture that very thin that for su2 it looks like that. Perhaps I can comment later on about what I think what this physically might mean or might not mean. So yeah, as I said, I mean, as you can see, with the automorphisms, the information is completely delocalized, right? There's no information about where things are in the manifold. But the manifold is basically lost, which is in some sense a good physical picture, because I mean without anything to localize things, you don't know where anything is. So that just, I mean, mathematically speaking, there are just very, very few diffeomorphism invariant observables known, for instance, for pure gravity. It's very difficult to do this. So the only thing that you can really know or what's really diffeomorphism invariant in the classical theory is things like curvature. A flat manifold is something different than a curved manifold. But I mean, what is curvature? Curvature is parallel transport around small closed loops, non-trivial. Parallel transport around small closed loops. So you can think of this as, right, because this is just very heuristic, and I would not be so, would be very careful with this, but you can think of this as being curvature quanta excited somewhere, but you don't know where at all they're excited.
A question concerning these. If you can distinguish between three and four dimensions. So you don't know how to see if you're generating a knotted graph using that base then.
Yes, exactly.
So you cannot identify the C's in such a way that it's a knot coming out.
So you can.
You cannot choose C's and coefficient C's in such a way that this graph you'll be generating would be a knotted graph.
Already, if all of these C's are zero and only one of these C's is one, then you get, so okay, forget about all this here. Just take one equivalence class. In this equivalence class, there will be a function cylindrical over a graph with knotting. But in this equivalence class, there will also be a function cylindrical over a graph, for instance, with the same combinatorics but without knotting, or with a different knotting.
Yeah, but if it is knotted or not, it depends on the dimensions of the.
But it's completely incentive. The automorphism group takes
from
any embedding. If you fix the graph, the combinatorial graph takes you from any embedding of that graph with any knotting.
You would embed it without
a knot. Let Ben really finish, and then maybe we can have a nice discussion afterwards.
Yeah, because
you're almost done, right?
So. Yes, I mean, this is a summary, and we've also got the output. If the gravitational degrees of freedom are delocalized, and the idea of how one could localize these things is adding matter. I mean, if you add matter to this framework, I mean, to the kinematical framework, you know that matter is situated at vertices, and for instance, if it's not a scalar field, transforms non-trivial under the gauge transformations. What made these things so really delocalized was the fact that if I have a graph, for instance, I can map it by an automorphism to some other graph where the paths intersect with each other and somehow it looks like they're generating vertices. But if you have matter situated at some vertices that knows about that vertex, then you really know about that vertex, that this is a proper vertex, and don't know, I mean, no can distinguish whether this is just a vertex where matter sits or whether this is just a vertex that looks like a vertex because the path intersects with each other at this strange point. So doing the same thing with matter again, it's really might be a way of getting a different automorphism in the Hilbert space, of course, but also the elements of which might look much more like one what one would know, like the real combinatorial graph might be. Because then the really important question is whether you can define, now we have this automorphism invariant Hilbert space, can you define physical operators on these? So can you have something like a volume operator or a master constraint operator, which you can define on this space? Of course, so far mathematically it looks very beautiful and really nice, but if you don't have these operators, then you can't do much physics with it. So the goal is now really to define these operators on the space, and there's some discussion that's going on with Hans Brunnemann from Hamburg, who knows a lot about the volume operator. So, and in particular, also the visit would be really nice to see whether one could make contact with the algebraic quantum gravity, which was introduced by Giesen and Thiemann, which really has this picture of the combinatorial graph sitting there. This looks really different. So here, one, it's not easy to see the connection. But I think with matter again, the connection might be really there might be much better to see. And the final point is, in particular, since on this Hilbert space there is such a volume operator, there is a master constraint operator, there might be some way of learning of how to do this in this space. And the last point I want to mention is categories are good for three manifolds and Riemannian metrics on that. And in this sense, four-dimensional Lorentz metrics are good to describe with two categories. So is there some way of doing the same thing and viewing the four diffeomorphisms as automorphisms of the two category? And could this bring some connection to spinfold, for instance? So these are ideas that are going on now. And as I talked exactly an hour now, I thank you for your attention.
Thank you for the nice and clear talk. Are there any questions, comments? Florian?
How practical is the framework really as long as you don't have an orthonormal basis? Or as long as you don't know what the orthonormal is?
Just as practical as any formulation without an orthonormal basis, not much, right? I mean, without an orthonormal basis, it's good to see that things work so far, but I mean, this is not really far developed. I agree, of course. You have to get an orthonormal basis in order to know something about that space. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Okay, so it's a useful thing to talk about that you can construct that.
Yes. So we're going to try to construct the spaces. Without the spaces, of course, it's difficult to see anything in the Hilbert space. So you can make some qualitative statements of things, but without the spaces, of course, we don't know much.
So
what you want us is to basically consider one-dimensional structures in PaaS. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to also include some information about two-dimensional structures, surfaces, or three-dimensional structures?
Well, yes, in two ways. First of all, you can look at automorphisms of two categories, but probably you're hinting towards the electric fluxes. There's not only the holonomies, there are also the fluxes. I haven't talked about these here because there was no time. Unfortunately, I've seen today I've announced this in the talk abstract, but I would talk about this, but I didn't. For the fluxes, you can do exactly the same thing. You can write them down in category language. You can say an oriented surface is a functor from da 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 da, and write down the corresponding electric flux operators and build up the holonomy flux algebra. This generated by these. These transform nicely under automorphisms. Of course, these are much more than just the surfaces that you embed in the manifold, but are of a more general class.
So the group of automorphism doesn't get smaller? I mean, do you preserve more information?
No. I mean, if you want to preserve all the analytic surfaces, mm-hmm. Yes, but if you take the lessons from category, want to take the lessons from category seriously and say, well, what does a surface do combinatorially? It just tells you where the path is cut, whether it passes through it or whether it doesn't. And this gives you somehow a combinatorial way of defining what a surface is. And this set of surfaces which is of course more general because there are more general ways to combinatorially cut things, these are left invariant by the automorphisms.
You
want to
say something?
Yeah, so I mean, the mathematics is very pretty. The mathematics is always very pretty. The question is this a suitable description for quantum gravity? Now, I want to understand your attitude. There are two attitudes to making a quantum theory of gravity. One is you just posit something and we'll work it out. Okay, in which case you have to show us you get back general relativity at the end.
Mm-hmm.
The other is to derive from general relativity. If you derive it from general relativity, you want to get back the Hilbert space on which you construct operators that represent observables that are observables of the classical theory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know if the group is diffeomorphisms, we don't quite get the right thing. Smooth diffeomorphisms, we don't quite get the right thing because of the non-separability issue. If we go to the Carlo and Winston slide extension, we still don't get bang on the observables of general relativity because we know there are these braids which are independently preserved. So we know that there are additional excitations, these noiseless subsystems that might be particles or something. And you may like that or not like that, but the answer is you get general relativity plus some additional degrees of freedom. You take it further and you get rid of all of those. So you have nothing again but combinatorics. You might have just posited that, in which case there'd be no argument. But now you want to claim you've quote derived this from some mathematical considerations in the path of quantizing general relativity. So I think the question that you have to answer is there any observable of classical general relativity which you can represent in the Hilbert space you have left over? So you've told us that the topology, which is an observable in classical general relativity, is one of topological invariants are some of the few space-time diffeomorphism of variant observables, we know how to describe explicitly. Okay, so that's gone. So there's a class of observables, a class of general relativity that you know are not representable. The dimension, you can measure many different ways. It must be a physical observable. And that's gone. You have no way to measure the dimension. You have no way to distinguish the quantization of classical general relativity in any number of dimensions greater than three, if what we're conjecturing is true. So those observables are gone. So, are there any observables of classical general relativity that you expect to be able to capture in this Hilbert space?
Well, let me disagree on this point, what you just said. You said that, for instance, the dimension is an observable. How would you measure a dimension without matter, for instance? I mean, a dimension of matter, the dimension of space, I think, what could, for instance, be measured by some heat distribution and just kind of let this spread out, and the more dimensions this heat distribution has, the more space it has, it will spread out in different ways. I think, I agree with you, it looks like the spaces look really, really small, and that's also why I said it would be really good to see whether you can add matter to this. But for the matter case, for instance, I mean, what would be physical observables with matter? It would be like, what is the value of the scalar field at some point where the curvature is like this? You would build up this relational picture. As soon as you have this relational picture, this matter at hand, where you could have something like matter situated at that vertex, you could really talk about this vertex. You could really say something like, what is, you know, this spin quantum number situated at the edge going off from the vertex where, I don't know, where the matter field has this or that value. I mean, I think matter would be a real good way to really recapture things that we know and that we can measure. On the other hand, I would really say that without matter, it's really difficult to measure anything in general relativity.
But general, I mean, Bianca has shown that general relativity has real local observables that can be constructed mm-hmm. explicitly without matter. So are you just giving up the hope of representing those in a Hilbert space?
No, but I mean, these observables would something. These observables would like then depend on where are things where the curvature invariant is like that, for instance, or where curvature is like that. Yeah, but I mean, you can ask questions like, how are things where this how many of these blobs are there where the spin quantum number is J2. Of course, this is a very vague sense, right? But I think there might be a way of getting the observables of pure gravity out from this framework. Although, of course, I'm not sure, and I agree. I mean, this is the real, this is the tremendously important question. This is why I really would like to see whether with matter this might be getting better. But even on the vacuum space, you're right. I mean, even on this vacuum case, you have to at least get something like this volume operator. Because without this volume operator, you can't really do much. I agree. I mean, I really agree to what you said. But I'm in a sense hopeful that one can solve these issues.
Okay, time for one more question.
Okay, I don't understand one issue, which is that you have actually the dimension as some kind of operator. It's just the fashion of you would have states which have some kind of well-defined or some semi-classical states which have some certain dimension. But you have also weird states where you can't even attach to them any dimension in this framework.
So you're making a claim that there are functionals on the Hilbert space secants after the end after he's modded out by the automorphism group, which even though there's no, we're conjecturing that the Hilbert space is identical for had you started with dimension 3 or above, that there still will be observables that somehow can measure a dimension.
For nice, I mean, that gives you some number which for nice states, and for nice semi-classical states would give you something like a dimension.
Do you agree?
I think not knowing the dimension just from path combinatorics is not too strange.
There are other ways of measuring the dimension of combinatorics.
Yeah, but I mean, if I have just a combinatorial graph, for instance, no one tells me how big the dimension of the space is in which I embed.
Right.
So how do we expect this dimension, for instance, to pop up at all in this framework? This could be some dynamical issue, for instance. I mean, this could be happening by some procedure that has been worked out by Wall and Amir and collaborators, where they start with some really something that's combinatorial, but have some evolution that makes the space four-dimensional in some dynamical way.
There's a simple way to distinguish three from everything above three, which is that there's a huge degeneracy of three, which is all the braiding and knotting, which is only a three. And so the Hilbert space of states which are invariant under smooth diffeomorphisms of embeddings of graphs into three-dimensional manifolds is much, much larger than the combinatorial one because of the possibility of braiding and knotting, whereas embedded in higher dimensional spaces, it's much closer to the combinatorial one. Because basically, and in higher dimensions, something like the following is true, I don't know exactly how to say it, that any embedding of a graph, any two embeddings of a graph are diffeomorphic.
Yeah.
Into a four or higher dimensional manifold. So what you lose by going from smooth diffeomorphisms to your automorphisms in four or more dimensions is not much. Mm-hmm. But in three dimensions is a huge amount of the Hilbert space.
You're losing also a lot in higher dimensions because two dimensional structures, for instance. I mean in four dimensions you're right, there are no knottings. With lines, but there are, for instance, knottings with surfaces. Right? Surfaces can have knots. Two-dimensional surfaces can have knots in four dimensions.
Right, but so this was related to Bjarne's question about higher-dimensional structures.
Mm-hmm.
So do you need to invent in the thing, precise thing you presented? There are no higher-dimensional structures, but there are higher-dimensional.
No, you can, for instance, represent that the surfaces that I've not talked about, but they're just. You can just the surfaces which are dual to the graphs, dual to the edges, because it's the conjugate momentum classically. You can represent these also on these Hilbert spaces, I mean, on the kinematical Hilbert space.
Okay.
You can also mount these out.
Okay, so then I can wish.
Okay, one last question from Randall.
Yeah, I want to ask a question about application to the cone. Yeah, but you have gone, but maybe, sorry, it's a poetic question. So I'll ask you afterward and let him take my last question.
Okay, you take the last question.
Okay. I was going to come back to Bianca's question and Lee's point about higher dimensional things. Mm-hmm. If you kind of extend it, so you were talking about doing having a dual to an edge, but if you have it dual, like the surface is dual to an edge, but you also have surfaces which you can see them as also morphisms from edges between the same points.
You mean in this two category?
Yeah, you can also see them as in this two category. You have two edges between the same point. Morphisms between them can represent surfaces.
Yes, then in the two category framework, the surfaces are maps between, are morphisms between morphisms. You're right.
Yeah.
But these are not included here. But this is what I would like to do.
This is what you'd like to do.
Yes, and in the four dimensional case, because I just think this would also be much closer to
in the four. No, I'm talking about still in the same.
Still in the three dimensional.
Yes, still in the same three dimensional case. That way you actually seem to have more structure to be able to recover the manifold, and you have something in this. You have this sort of relationship, because if you only have it as duals to you don't have any relationship between the edges and the surfaces, which kind of doesn't give you, you it's not clear that you get the pi 2 structure. Whereas if you have the edges both as mm-hmm. as a dual to edges and also as morphisms from edges to edges on the same point, then you have this relationship which somehow kind of gives you the pi 2 structure and might mm-hmm. give you the structure.
Yes.
Yes,
right. To be honest, I'm not sure whether any automorphism from just the category could not be just extended to one of the corresponding two categories where you also check the surfaces in between. Probably that's not possible. And if it's, although I didn't say, but if it's not possible, then it would be really interesting to look at this point of what happens if you preserve less structure in some way. But these surfaces somehow did not appear in the framework so far. Because these surfaces are a different notion of surface than being dual to an edge.
Yeah, exactly.
So
what I'm saying is if you have both, then you have the concept of I have a curve here and I have this curve going through that curve.
Yes, yeah.
So you have this relationship where mm-hmm. you see something, whereas if you only have the dual thing, then it's difficult to see that relationship of, you know, something, this is a flux
yeah.
between the other thing. It's difficult to recreate the manifold out of that.
Yeah, yeah, but anyway, nothing is, you're right, nothing is not something that is just at the curves, right? But nothing is some combinatorial information about how curves cut surfaces. So this could be a way of
very good, very good. Let's thank the speaker.